You think about the early 70s, equal right amendment, women marching in the streets. Women are just starting to integrate into firefighting and police forces. And I mean, there's still places in the country where if you're a school teacher and you become pregnant, you have to leave. And the most popular TV series, this is our idea of iconic women leadership, is Charlie's Angels.
That was Admiral Michelle Howard, the U.S. Navy's groundbreaking four-star admiral, talking about what America was like back in the 1970s when she first dreamed of attending the U.S. Naval Academy. Women were barred from the service academies back then, but when Michelle Howard finally got in, she went all the way to the top. I'm Alain Verveer, and this is Seneca's 100 Women to Hear. We are bringing you 100 of the world's most inspiring and history-making women you need to hear. Michelle Howard is a woman of many firsts. America's first female four-star admiral. The first African-American woman to command a Navy ship. And both the first woman and the first African-American to be vice chief of naval operations. Today, Admiral Howard is retired from the Navy, but she's continuing to use her military experience to serve her country in other ways. Listen and learn why Admiral Michelle Howard is one of Seneca's 100 women to hear. Well, I'm so delighted to be here today with Admiral Michelle Howard. If anyone is a trailblazer, it is she. Also, she's just an extraordinary person in every way. Admiral Howard, so wonderful to see you.
Good to see you, Madam Ambassador. And I got to say, I never thought of myself as a trailblazer until I made one star. And then for Women's History Month, DOD gave me an actual trailblazing award.
Well, that was well deserved. I'm glad they finally caught up with you. So let me begin by saying you are indeed a woman of many firsts, including the first woman to become a four-star admiral in the U.S. Navy, not a single star alone. What was it in your growing up, in your background, what made you look for success in the Navy and contributed to your being such a groundbreaker? Because it's always so fascinating to hear how people of accomplishment were influenced by their growing up.
Right. So in my case, I was 12 when I saw a documentary on television. I actually think it was about the Air Force Academy. And I was enthralled with the teamwork, the uniforms, the leadership opportunity. And I said, oh, my gosh, that's what I want to do. And then I went to my older brother, who made it pretty clear I wouldn't be allowed to go to a service academy because it was against the law. And I was just stunned. So I went to my mother, who said, yup, your older brother's telling you the truth. But wait, you're just 12. You might change your mind. But if you don't change your mind, I encourage you when you're old enough to apply. And if you're rejected because you're a woman, we'll sue the government. And I was amazed. And then she gave me a really great life lesson. She said, look, if this is what you want to do and you think it's right, you should pursue it. But if we have to file a lawsuit, it could take years to get to the Supreme Court. And by the time they make a decision, you could be too old to go. But it might mean other women get to go instead, and that's just as important. So she was trying to teach me, go after what you believe is right, and don't worry about the benefit to yourself. It's about the benefit to the community that's most important. So luckily for me, the law changed when I was 16. I still wanted to go. I applied when I was 17, and life in the Navy started at 18.
You know, what a wise mother you had, and what a gutsy lady to say, if they don't change that law, we'll just take it all the way up to the court system. But as you said, fortunately, it changed, and you were the beneficiary of what took place in 1976. When the U.S. Naval Academy, West Point, and the other service academies were finally open to women. And it couldn't come soon enough. You entered in 78, and you were only one of seven Black women in your class of more than 1,300 students. Extraordinary. So can you give us a sense of what it was like to be in that class?
Well, I think we need to put it in context, right? Where the country was in 78. So, you know, you think about the early 70s, Equal Right Amendment, women marching in the streets, women burning their bras. And I was 12 when that was happening. I didn't understand that at all. So by the time I'm starting in 78, the Supreme Court is still all male. So there's no, it's about to happen, but there's no Sandra Day O'Connor yet, right? Women are just starting to integrate into firefighting and police forces. And I mean, there's still places in the country where if you're a school teacher and you become pregnant, you have to leave. You can't teach anymore. And the most popular TV series, this is our idea of iconic women leadership, is Charlie's Angels. So we're a befuddled country, I think, at that point. And so then, I'm in the third year group of women who've started Annapolis, and our seniors are the last all male class, and they are still angry and frustrated that this huge change has happened. And years later, there was a wise CNO who said, you know, change is like a new pair of shoes. Change hurts your mind the way a new pair of shoes hurts your feet. But eventually you get comfortable. And so we were at the hurt and mind stage, and many of the male midshipmen were acting out because of that. So it was a rite of passage, I think, for the women who were going through Annapolis during those years. So I'm in admiration of all my women classmates who basically, to me, survived and went on to become leaders in the service.
Well, I know that just being at any of the service academies is quite challenging. And to be a change maker among a group of change makers must have brought its own challenges. I wonder, at any point, did you feel a sense of dropping out? I just can't hack this. Or were you just determined, set your mind to it, and ultimately prevailed?
We started off, there were four roommates, and one of them dropped out our plebe summer, our first year, the indoctrination summer, due to pressures from the male midshipmen. And after that, I initiated a conversation with my other three roommates. And we actually were very deeply in contact. We call each other roommates for life.
Love it.
And we made a pact that if any one of us was going to quit, we had to talk to the other three and convince them that we were quitting for personal reasons, not because we were being pressured. And I think that pact kept us together, and all four of us graduated.
I love that. A pact among fellow students who were in a similar situation and supporting each other. There's great, great wisdom in that as well. So you went on to be the first African-American woman to command a ship in the United States Navy. And I think, I dare say, for most of us, we don't know what it means to command a ship. So could you tell us what those obligations are like? And then again, because you were a first, did that present any special challenges?
The period of when I took command was about 5 or 6 years after the combat exclusion law had been repealed. So on top of me being the first African-American woman to take command of a ship, I'm in the first five women who've been selected to command a combatant ship that, you know, prior to 94, we weren't allowed to serve on. And then when I took command, my XO, my number two, just happened to be a woman. So now we're on a amphibious ship. The CEO is going to be a woman, and the number two is going to be a woman. So what I was not expecting was the media attention. So, you know, a change of command is open, and then you just don't really expect the local newspapers or Associated Press to be interested in a unit change of command, but they were. And so I was not ready, I think, mentally prepared for that level of focus, which continued on through my time as a CO. Well, to me, the commanding officer of a ship, it's a wonderful privilege. And it generally, for the Navy, it takes about 18 to 21 years of experience at sea to get to that level. And then you own everything. And that really hits home when you actually literally have to sign for this ship, this multi-billion dollar asset. You literally have to sign for it.
Oh, my God.
But, you know, the most important thing is the crew. You're responsible for the safe navigation and safety of that ship. So even before you talk about combat, just getting from A to B, properly driving the ship, you know, and being underway and making sure that the crew is, each individual member of the crew is successful at what they do. That's the leadership part, but it's also the very fundamental nature of you are responsible for these people's lives. So if you have a collision, sailors are going to die. And America has trusted their sons and daughters to you. And then on an amphibious ship, you generally have Marines. So the deployment I went on, I had about 260 sailors. And then we had about 300 Marines embarked. And then underway, you're responsible for all of them. And then you're responsible for training your ship so that the crew and everybody's ready to do the high-end missions. So whether it's maritime security operations or piracy operations, you as the CO have got to make sure your crew is trained and ready all the time.
What an enormous responsibility. And do you always have that sense of responsibility every day that you're doing it, or does it ease a little bit?
No, you're never off duty, so to speak, while you're in command of the unit, because anything can happen at any minute of the day. You know, there, it's not a 5 day a week, 9 to 5 job. It's more like a 5 to 9 job, 7 days a week, with an ability to take wake up calls in the middle of the night if necessary.
Seneca's 100 Women to Hear will be back after this short break.
You mentioned leadership in the context of the ship and what you needed to do. And early on, you had mentioned, when I described you as a trailblazer, you said that your leadership was recognized after you got that first star. But you have won so many awards since for your leadership, all with good reason, needless to say. Do you think that women's leadership is different? If it is, how is it different? And because leadership is such an important part of what you represent, your career, the military, how do you define leadership?
So I've often, and I've said this over the years, people are individuals, and it's fascinating that some people claim, oh, women lead differently than men. You know, I have met leaders, I've met charismatic, kind of over the top women leaders and charismatic over the top male leaders. And, you know, the difference is how we describe them. We're going to say the male leader's passionate, and we're going to say the women leader's emotional. Their behavior's the same, but we want to put these gender lenses on the behavior and describe it differently. So I think leadership is very individual. And for folks who are in training to be a leader, you just have to sort of find your strengths and then emphasize those strengths and use them to develop your teams. My favorite definition of leadership I came across years ago is leadership is an inability to stand by and watch things go to hell. That's leadership.
That's excellent. I must remember that one. So one of the other things I've come to know about you and admire you so is that you've been so personally committed to diversity and inclusion. I want to believe that the day is going to come where we all do much better, whatever sector we're involved in, whether it's government or companies. But why is it so important to our national security as well? I don't think so often that we think about that. We've talked about, I know, a great deal in recent weeks, especially about the importance of diversity and inclusion in the work of our foreign service officers, our diplomats. But why is it so important to national security?
Well, in the case of defense, we live in a democratic society that's an all-volunteer force. So then when you look across this nation, it is extremely diverse. The guardians of this nation must reflect the breadth of diversity that exists. And then in the case of it's an all-volunteer force, you cannot start segmenting. I'm only going to try and recruit from one sector of that population. That you need to, for defense, make the entire population available and try and pull in across the great America all the different talent that's out there. And so in terms of manning Army units, manning ships, aviation squadrons, we're recruiting folks to come in, and they're coming in as volunteers. But we need a big pull, so we need all of America. And then in terms of trust, the American citizen needs to look to defense and say, yep, that defense represents me, represents my hometown, represents what I look like, and represents America. And so it's intrinsic to national security for us to be a diverse Department of Defense, diverse military members.
So well said. And another way that the whole diversity issue comes up within the U.S. military is the need to diversify within combat areas, specifically career fields, as you mentioned, like infantry or flying fighter jets. They tend to dominate the highest levels of military leadership.
Or driving ships.
And commanding ships, indeed. It wasn't that many years ago when many of these roles were not open to women.
No. So when you look at the playing field, if the opportunity is closed off, then you're not going to have future leaders who are women. So for the Air Force and the Navy, when the combat exclusion law was repealed in 93 and 94, the main missions of the Air Force and the Navy opened up to women. Women could now, in the Navy, not only serve on support ships, we could serve on destroyers and cruisers and aircraft carriers. Women were now no longer constrained to fly support aircraft. They could fly fighter aircraft. So when you look at the senior leadership of the Navy and the Air Force, because that opportunity opened up decades ago, that meant women could move into the main mission and then grow up to be an admiral or general. And it takes, in any of the services, about 25 years to create the body of experience in a human being to become an admiral or general. So if the playing field's not equal, and then there's not enough diversity in those main missions of the services, there's no pool for people to grow up and be in that successful group of colonels and captains who someday are going to be the 1, 2, 3, and 4 stars. So the services, I think over the last few years, have started to recognize this, and in their different ways are trying to, as men and women go into the service academies or ROTC, start doing mentoring early and encourage women and diverse members to go into the combat arms side of the services instead of, you know, I feel more comfortable in the supply side, logistics side, because someday I'll leave and that gives me skill sets I can use in the outside world. No, think about the main mission and the fun and excitement you're going to have in the main mission. And trust me, the leadership skills you're going to develop will work in the business world someday. So we've got to do more mentoring to move candidates into those career fields.
And it is so important, particularly for women who've wanted to succeed, let alone at the level that you've done so. to have those opportunities.
Yeah, absolutely. And if the playing field is legally the same, it's there. And so for the Navy, one of my classmates from Annapolis was the first woman to be the head of the CB Corps. And because the combat exclusion law was repealed, that meant she commanded CB battalions on her way up. She was in Iraq on the ground as a CB. So those opportunities exist when the law is equal. You know, my services already had a female fighter pilot. She's now a 2-star. We had a women diver make 2-star. So it's there. It just, we have to make sure that women and diverse members know the opportunities are there and encourage them to pursue that type, that those mission sets.
And it's been a journey, clearly. And it has mattered so much to have changes in the law, recognizing that it's time. And I think you put that so well in terms of your own experiences and what it means to so many others. Speaking of time, we have time for one more question. And I know that this has been a difficult time for our world, a very challenging time. We're still living through this pandemic, but there's so many other issues that we need to deal with. And I wonder what makes you so optimistic and so hopeful about the future?
So in the aftermath of the George Floyd killing and the subsequent protest across the country, what gave me hope is the fact that these were American citizens from all walks of life protesting, that it wasn't just African-Americans who saw this as injustice. It was the citizens of the country who saw injustice and were protesting against that. And that gives me hope that when the citizens say, okay, this is wrong, and this is not about George Floyd as an African American. This is about a citizen who lost his life, and we all need to be supportive and push for justice in this country. So the fact that the protesters mirrored America, that's what gives me hope.
That's a wonderful insight, because I think for so many of us, seeing us come together at that moment, it didn't matter who we were or where we came from, what color we were, what ethnic background we had, but crying out for justice, coming together for justice. And it's so important in these times, especially. I cannot thank you enough. I'm sure that our listeners feel very privileged indeed to have had this moment with you, Admiral Michelle Howard. Truly, you are a figure in history now. And we're just grateful to you for your service to the country, but for everything that you represent in terms of your leadership. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our country is so lucky to have leaders like Admiral Michelle Howard. Here are three things I took away from that conversation. First, if you want to achieve something difficult, you have to take the long view. When she was just a child, Michelle Howard wanted to attend the U.S. Naval Academy. Women were barred from entry in those days. But her mother told her, "If you know it's the right thing, be prepared to fight all the way to the Supreme Court, not for yourself, but for the benefit of others." Second, when women stick together, they can accomplish anything. When Michelle Howard did get to Annapolis, she was just one of a handful of women there. She and three other women made a pact to support each other, and all of them graduated. Finally, diversity makes our military stronger and our country safer. As Admiral Howard says, Americans need to be able to look at the military and say that defense represents me, represents my hometown, represents what I look like, represents America. Tune in next Thursday to hear about our next featured woman and discover why she's one of Seneca's 100 women to hear.
Seneca's 100 Women to Hear is a collaboration between the Seneca Women Podcast Network and iHeartRadio, with support from founding partner P&G. Have a great day.